Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A series of bombings across Iraq have left at least 58 people dead, 200 wounded. The attacks followed the killing by U.S. and Iraqi forces of senior leaders of al-Qaeda in Iraq. The government of Greece formally requested international funding to help alleviate its debt crisis. And Iceland closed two airports today because of the ash from the volcano that brought European air travel to a near standstill. Joining me to talk about the top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, Abderrahim Fukara of Al Jazeera, Trudy Rubin of the Philadelphia Inquirer, and Roy Gutman of McClatchy News. Do join us 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook. Send us a tweet. Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
This death toll in Iraq. Two top al-Qaeda leaders were killed. Tell us about it, Roy.
Well, today's bombings show that even though the leadership has been decapitated, so to speak, al-Qaeda Iraq is alive and still has a lot of suicide bombers trained and ready to go and to attack. And it's still so incredible to me. People at their Friday prayers in the mosques of Baghdad. I think it just should induce a certain amount of humility among the Americans and the Iraqi officials who, in a somewhat triumphalist mood this week, proclaimed that they had really broken the back of al-Qaeda.
You know, we've heard that before, and now to have this kind of enormously effective retaliatory attack, as you say, should bring some humility.
Absolutely, Diane. We've definitely heard this before. We've heard it under President Obama. We certainly had heard it during the Bush administration. And every time they say that they've broken the back of al-Qaeda, they'll kill one or two top leaders, and then they would be replaced, and things go back to business as usual. What's really sinister this time, from the point of view of the plan that the Obama administration has to get out of Iraq, is that all this mess now is happening in Iraq 6 weeks after the election. And 6 weeks after the election, the Iraqis, we don't even know yet who's actually won the election. So if there was a trepidation in light of the vacuum that happened post the 2005 election for several months before they actually got a government going. Think about it this time. 6 weeks, we don't even know who the winner is.
Trudy, are they still counting ballots?
Yes. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's party appealed the count in Baghdad, and the votes are being recounted there. And needless to say, this has encouraged other parties to talk about wanting recounts in their areas. This Baghdad recount should be finished in a week, but it is important that to say that al-Qaeda here clearly has a strategy. You only need a handful of people to have a strategy like this, and suicide bombers who come from outside and come in. And the strategy is to try to provoke sectarian warfare. I was in Baghdad just a week ago, and there were warnings that al-Qaeda was trying to steal an airplane and fly it into a holy Shiite shrine, possibly the shrine of Imam Ali, the holiest, in Najaf. And in fact, there were stories out of the Czech Republic that that might have been where they tried to get a plane and somebody was stopped there, Iraqis. So there is a clear effort to provoke sectarian war. I don't think the country wants it. They are sick of it. But it will take a lot of careful maneuvering for this election process to not spin off the rails. Right now, the United States is trying to stand back. I think they're going to have to get more involved in mediation.
Now, what about the question of allegations of fraud and what's happening in terms of violence, do you think this could affect U.S. decisions to move out Abderrahi?
Well, we've had reassurances from the top brass of the U.S. military in Iraq that it will not affect the decision to withdraw U.S. troops. But those decisions were made when things looked promising, that there would be an election in Iraq and that some sort of government would emerge, even if it emerges a little late, that could take care of the security situation. Now we have this thing that's just been mentioned. You have the Prime Minister Maliki contesting the result of the election. And because of that, you have Allawi, his competitor, also contesting the election now and demanding a recount in the south. You have some of the Kurdish parties also demanding a recount in some parts of northern Iraq. So this whole thing seems to be unraveling, and then you get the violence, the thing about Al-Qaeda and also about the prison that the Prime Minister was accused of running, where inmates were alleged to have been tortured.
And you also had the case of Navy SEALs accused of abusing a prisoner, Trudy.
Let me say that I think that Navy SEAL case is peanuts compared to previous cases. I really don't think that Iraqis are going to pay too much attention to the release because, you know, after much bigger cases like Abu Ghraib, where higher-ups were not punished, or the case where Blackwater shot up 17 people in a major square in Baghdad, you know, this is really tiddlywinks. I think the torture case has more possibility of upsetting people because there was a secret torture facility at the Mutana Airport base, where I just was nearby last week, and many Sunnis were held there. And the key in this election situation is whether Sunnis feel they have sufficient place in the government. Let me add, my driver was tortured in that facility just in January. And this is typical of the problems now in Iraq. He is a Shiite who protested against the killing of Sunnis in his neighborhood by Jaish-Mahdi Shiite militiamen. He helped U.S. and Iraqi forces to roll up those militiamen, and when the U.S. pulled out, the Jaish-Mahdi got their revenge, and they have contacts in the army and the police. And this man has been in jail for 16 months and been tortured because he helped Americans and Iraqis. So I think Prime Minister Maliki, the other political leaders, will have a lot to do to prevent sectarian tensions from getting out of hand. And as I said, I think the U.S. is going to have to play a bigger role than they now want to do.
I wanted to come back to the elections, if I could, because the recount, because it is often assumed that Iraq, being a third world country without a great tradition of free elections, cannot conduct good elections. But the actual fact is, and the record is, that their own independent election commission has run very, very solid elections. It's true the politicians want recounts, and of course, what politician doesn't if he's on the losing end? But in fact, in the last, I think it was the provincial elections, I was there myself in Iraq some months ago and talked to commission members, and they said that of the 40,000 polling places around the country, in the previous provincial elections, only about, I think, 1% had genuine problems of over too many ballots or something going awry. So I think that part of the process is actually more intact than most people realize.
If the recount, at least in Baghdad, which I understand is about 20%, represents about 20% of the vote, the overall vote, if the recount gives an additional 2 or 3 seats to the Prime Minister Maliki, who is, by the current results, is lagging behind his competitor Iyad Allawi by 2 seats. If that happens, number one, we don't know how Iyad Allawi is going to react. Number two, and this has a very important regional dimension, Iyad Allawi is a Shiite, but because he canvassed heavily among the Sunnis in Iraq, he gave hope to the regions of Iraq, the Sunni regions of Iraq, the Saudis, among others, that if a government that emerges in which he plays a very active role, then they could do business with the Iraqi government as opposed to Prime Minister Maliki, who is perceived by the Sunnis as being too close to Iran.
Could you end up with something like a mixed government? And if you did, what kind of power would there actually be, Trudy?
I think that is the goal. It is certainly the goal of Prime Minister Maliki. I talked to one of his top advisors last week, and he told me that their strategy is to try to bring all the blocs in. There are two major Shia blocs, one major Sunni bloc headed by a Shiite, Mr. Alawi, and a big Kurdish bloc. And Maliki is talking to all of them. The Kurds have not ruled out going with Maliki, and there are probably Sunnis who might make a deal. There are all kinds of issues in play, such as whether the president of Iraq, instead of being a Kurd as he now is, might be a Sunni. What cabinet posts. The consequence of parceling everything out by sect and ethnicity, however, is going to be a government of patronage that really doesn't hold together and perform well. On the other hand, such a government might be necessary to prevent sectarian upheaval. And my guess is this is the direction it's going to go. The question is, how long will it take them to agree on a prime minister?
Trudy Rubin, she's foreign affairs columnist, editorial board member at the Philadelphia Inquirer. We'll take a short break here. When we come back, we'll talk about Greece, its call for a financial package, what that means for the rest of the world and us. And welcome back to the international portion of our Friday News Roundup this week with Trudy Rubin of the Philadelphia Inquirer, Roy Gutman of McClatchy Newspapers, and Abderrahim Fukara. He's Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Arabic. Join us by phone, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Let's turn to Greece. What does it actually mean that Greece has called for activation of a financial rescue package? Abderrahim.
Well, I mean, I find it extraordinary that a country like Greece, right in the heart of the European financial system, is now acting like a third world country and asking for a bailout from the Europeans themselves, but also from the world. Going to the World Bank and to the International Monetary Fund is not something that has been associated with European countries, and yet it is happening, and it's indicative of the fact that despite the good signs that are emerging out of the United States in terms of the financial crisis, Europe could be pulling the world back into it.
About the EU reaction to this, Trudy?
Well, you know, Greece has taken advantage of being part of the European Union to continue to have a huge proportion, I'm sorry I don't have the figure, of its working force on the government payroll, enormous benefit packages, huge vacations, things that Americans, most Americans, wouldn't dream of. And it ran up a debt which it under reported. And so this makes the crisis even worse because nobody trusts Greek figures. And what happens is that European banks, especially German banks, have loaned money, so this can rebound on them. So Greece is hoping that the EU will bail it out, but thrifty Germans don't see why they should have to bail out profligate Greeks.
Roy Gutman.
Well, the problem is one of just the basis of the European Union's own currency, having the euro, and how to deal with a case where one country, with its own financial mismanagement, can be rescued from itself without having to charge the taxpayers of all the other countries. And the truth is, that's what they were in for. Once you started up a euro with this kind of widespread among profligate spenders and also austere spenders, sooner or later it was going to catch up with them. Of course, the Greeks have a huge responsibility. They don't pay their share of taxes. The country's whole fiscal system has been based on sleight of hand and concealment of their real debts. And the government, until this very latest government, has been unwilling to confront the public and tell them they've got to pay the price.
Here's an email on this very question from Les in Brattleboro, Vermont. How much is Greece's adoption of the euro responsible for its current debt woes? Also, is the euro at risk of being abandoned due to Greece's economic meltdown and similar impending meltdowns among the other Eurozone nations, for example, Poland, Italy, Ireland, and Spain?
You know, Diane, just before the program, we were talking about the election in the UK. And I lived in the UK for many, many years before moving to the United States. One of the issues that was always a hot potato in the UK is how much should we become part of the European monetary system? And I think that the British resisted that temptation precisely because of their fear of the kind of trouble that Greece is going through now. It comes at a moment when an increasing number of people are talking about the euro as an alternative to the dollar. And when you get noises made about making the euro an alternative to the dollar, not from the Iranians, or not just from the Iranians, not just from the Venezuelans, but from the head of the World Bank, you knew that the dollar was in real trouble. But this thing that's happening to Greece, I think it's going to make an awful lot of people reconsider if they were thinking that the euro could become anytime soon an alternative to the dollar.
Trudy.
And should Greece default, what will then happen is not only the banks that loan to Greece, including a lot of German banks, take, quote, a haircut, close quote, which means that they get paid only cents on the dollar. But Greece's interest rates have already skyrocketed. And other countries in the Eurozone where people suspect that their books might be somewhat cooked, like Italy, Ireland, Portugal, and Spain, the cost of borrowing for them will also rise. And one has to keep in mind that if sovereign debt, the debt of a country, if a sovereign country can go under, which hasn't happened since Russia defaulted back in the 90s, then people are going to start looking a little skeptically at the huge load of debt that the U.S. is putting on. Even though there's no comparison between our economies and there's much more transparency, we are putting on such a debt load that there certainly is a danger of increasing interest rates.
Here's an email that came in the last hour, but I felt belonged right here. It's from Ron in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He says, what are your thoughts about the IMF saying that the U.S. is moving too fast with financial reform? There needs to be global financial reform occurring simultaneously. Abd al-Rahim.
Well, I think one of the things that President Obama has done since the very early days of his administration is that he said he wanted to work in a multilateral context with the rest of the world, especially over the issue of the financial crisis. He met the Europeans, he met the G20, and basically that's what he was telling them. He was telling them that what's good for us is good for you, what's good for you is good for us. So the only way out of this mess is going to be if we actually work together. I don't know to what extent or what the United States specifically could do about this issue of Greece and the problems that it's posing for Europe. The real dilemma that the European Union faces now is that on the one hand, they, like as you said, the Germans are not particularly enthusiastic for bailing out the Greeks, but at the same time, the very notion of the European Union was actually constructed on financial and monetary integration. If financial and monetary integration fizzles out in Europe, then Europe is obviously in big trouble, and the rest of the world is going to be in big trouble too.
I think that one of the big problems with everybody else reforming their financial systems is that some countries, for example, the UK, Britain, is about to have an election. And this it paralyzes their ability to really come up with reforms. Britain is the absolute key, I think, to the financial reform, because London, the London market, next to New York, sometimes even ahead of New York, has been the place where so many of these terrible deals have been done. And Gordon Brown, the current prime minister, was of course the chancellor of the Exchequer when supervising. It was on his watch that all of this happened. Nevertheless, he's now a reborn reformer, and
except he's got an independent running against him, who is getting lots of traction, Trudy.
Well, that is true, but I just want to return to the U.S. on this, apart from the Brits, because you have to remember that the last time a whole set of international rules for regulation were put into place was after World War II, when the United States was the unquestioned leader. And I think we're going to find that without a country able to play that role, it's going to be like a bunch of cats in a room. You are not going to be able to get agreement. It may be too late for this kind of new rule setting to go on. Perhaps in the 90s, it could have been done when the U.S. still seemed to be the unipolar power. But I find it hard to believe now that you're going to get agreement on the kind of international regulation that's needed.
I want to go back to the election in the UK that Roy was talking about. I mean, what's interesting about this particular one is that the star of it so far have been the Liberal Democrats, not the Conservatives and not Labour. And the importance of the star Conservatives and their leader is that they've been calling for a reconsideration of Britain's relationship with the US following what's happened in Iraq, what's happened in Afghanistan. And obviously that would have financial ramifications. Liberal Democrats are unlikely to actually lead the government, but the UK could, because of them, end up with a hung government like what happened in the 70s, which would make working with the United States and on the financial crisis very difficult.
All right, let's turn to Iran and comments that the vice president made, saying he expects new sanctions against Iran in the next few weeks. Trudy.
It is possible that there will be new sanctions against Iran, very targeted sanctions aimed mainly at issues connected with the nuclear industry and people connected with it. But these will not be the crippling sanctions that Hillary Clinton spoke about. And there seems to be general agreement that this will not really stop Iran's march towards nuclear capability to make a weapon. Whether they would break out is another question. And the doubts are so great that there was a leaked memo from Secretary of Defense Gates recently saying, does the administration have a plan B? Because President Obama has said that we would not let Iran get a nuclear weapon. But many people think now that the only strategy left for the U.S. is going to be containment of a nuclear capable Iran.
Now, what Secretary Gates' memo actually said was that the U.S. does not have a long-term plan should Iran get nuclear weapons. What does that mean to us?
Well, absolutely. I mean, before that, if I may just say one quick thing about the sanctions. I mean, the problem with the sanctions is that if they are a weak version of what they should be, as Trudy said, then obviously that's not going to get the United States anywhere, or the international community anywhere with Iran. If they are too biting, they are obviously not going to bite the government. They're going to bite the very people that the West is trying to put on its side.
And China won't sign on to biting sanctions.
Exactly. But look, ultimately, and we saw this in Iraq for over 12 years, ultimately sanctions do not work. What changed the regime in Iraq was not the sanctions, it was military action, although military action took the whole region and U.S. foreign policy in a different direction. Now, the issue of military action being on the table, I mean, we're hearing different things from the administration, sometimes that they say all the options are on the table. But you also hear other voices within the administration, and some of these voices are powerful ones, even from the Pentagon, who say, look, we really think of military action as being the very last resort, but we don't know what to do between now and then.
Abdel Rahim Fakara, he's Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Arabic, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's talk now about Israel. The New York Times is reporting there are new signs of life for Middle East peace talks. What are we hearing, Roy Gutman?
Well, on the one hand, there's the public and really brusque dismissal by Prime Minister Netanyahu of President Obama's concerns about Israel building new settlements in or settlement areas in East Jerusalem, but behind that bluster is in fact the possibility of a kind of a suspension of this expansion of settlements. It's really not clear. It's going to happen in a very subtle way, but
because, for
one thing, the United States is putting enormous pressure on Israel right now. But anyway, the way things happen in Israel when it comes to settlements is that you have to look at the schedule of the planning boards in the areas where construction is going to take place, and in this case. All planning, as we have for our own correspondent in Jerusalem, all planning has been suspended for these settlements. And this is something that the special envoy for the Middle East, George Mitchell, has just arrived in Israel. I think today he's supposed to see Palestinian leaders. And if indeed, and he's going to get their complaints, and then he's going to go to the Israelis probably in the next day or two, if the Israelis actually can give some kind of assurances that nothing actually will be happening in a de facto way, despite the fact that President and Prime Minister has made the decision, then it's not inconceivable that indirect talks can start up. This is not actually even the same as negotiations. This is the United States acting as kind of a courier between Palestinians and Israelis who might be in the same hotel or might even be in different hotels. And it's not even negotiations in another sense on substance. It's going to be negotiations about negotiations. Mm-hmm. So it's a very slow process.
But publicly, Benjamin Netanyahu is saying settlements are going to go on.
He said, quote, there will be no freeze, close quote. But apparently what he is trying to do is have all departments report to him on any plans that they have, so you will not have a huge gaffe as you had when Vice President Biden arrived and new building in East Jerusalem was announced just when he was there. Presumably, nobody will announce it. And if it happens, it will happen when no American is anywhere near the country.
So what you're saying is it may continue, but it's not going to be quite so public?
I mean, there may be a halt for a time. But I do not think there will be a permanent freeze. And I think the bigger issue, the issue that's now being debated in the Obama administration, is whether Obama should come out with an American plan. everyone knows this is very risky. You don't want to have come out with a plan as Ronald Reagan does and have it rebuffed on day one and nobody pays any attention to it. And furthermore, you have to have a strategy for what you'll do if one side or the other rebuffs it. When Obama got into this peace business and came out with the idea of a settlement freeze and corresponding concessions by Arab countries, confidence-building measures, his staff people had not done due diligence, and they were, and he was rebuffed by both sides. He came to Saudi Arabia, and it was a big no, and nobody had checked this out in advance. So the question is, if he's going to have a plan, he's got to have a strategy, and I think that's the big question now.
Trudy Rubin, the Philadelphia Inquirer. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll open the phones, read your email. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Sit for Less, selling all colors of the Herman Miller Aeron chair online, including Sit for Less True Black, online at sitforless.com. By Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, constantcontact.com. And by CSX, working to reduce traffic and pollution while moving 1 million tons of freight daily. CSX, how tomorrow moves. This is NPR.
And I dreamed about this game, fat man. I dreamed about this game every night on the road. Five ball.
That's Paul Newman in The Hustler. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to an interview with Dee Dee Allen, who edited The Hustler, Reds, Bonnie and Clyde, and many other films. She died Saturday at the age of 86. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Game.
And welcome back. It's time to open the phones. We'll go first to Charles. He's in Nashville, Tennessee. Good morning to you.
Hello. The David Brooks once said, David Brooks and a lot of other American reporters have quoted Al-Qaeda saying that they like to die like Americans, like Westerns like to live. But the truth of the matter, they say that they have the same relevance for death as Americans have for living. There's a difference. Pat Buchanan said that if we wasn't over there, if we wasn't never over there, they wouldn't be coming over here. So my point is that there's a lot of misrepresentation about the Al-Qaeda people, that there's none of the guests there this morning seem to be opposed to war, seem to be opposed to the path that we're going down, seems to be in opposition to anything that's going on. I believe that those people are no threat to me, that they're defending their homeland. And there's never a perspective. There's no one ever, to me, speaking their point of view. Thank you.
Thank you, Charles. I think a great many people are concerned about this. There has even been talk of a commission to investigate how we got into this war in the first place.
But let me say something specifically about Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, in Iraq at the present time. This is now basically not a homegrown movement. There are leaders that are homegrown who are radicals beyond the interest of any group in the country. The Sunni population of Iraq has rejected these people. Even a massive Sunni population that was opposed to the U.S. invasion and initially welcomed al-Qaeda because they thought they would help the Sunnis fight against the Americans. But they found that al-Qaeda was so vicious and destructive and brought in suicide bombers from outside of the country who blow up mosques and blow up innocent Iraqis. So this al-Qaeda does not reflect Iraqi interests, full stop.
All right.
Furthermore, they're not attacking American forces. They're not attacking the so-called former occupiers. They're attacking innocent civilians in mosques.
Here's an email following up on that from Herb. I'm sorry, it's his message on Facebook. He says, the constant updates of taking out an al-Qaeda leader and supposedly crippling the organization is not preventing the ongoing violence in Iraq. This never-ending carnage further illustrates why going into this nation for the fantasy of WMD or regime change was a very bad idea. Bring our people home up to Iraq.
Well, absolutely. I mean, there were a lot of people in the region prior to 2003 who said loud and clear Al-Qaeda did not exist in Iraq. And the premise of the Bush administration at that time was that, okay, let's go in Iraq and fight Al-Qaeda so that we wouldn't have to fight them on the streets of New York. There was no Al-Qaeda. Saddam, for all the atrocities that he's accused of having committed against his people, everybody knew that he was a staunch opponent of Al-Qaeda. Now you have Al-Qaeda operating in Iraq. Incidentally, during and post 2003 election, the borders of Iraq were left unattended and unguarded. And that created a situation that Trudy was talking about, of people actually flooding into Iraq. Now, one more thing, which is, I think, very important, that has to be said. In Afghanistan, when you had a lot of non-Afghans fighting the Soviets, the people who became later on known as the Afghan Arabs, the people who ultimately paid the price, it was the United States 9/11, but it was also many of the original Arab countries that they had come from, because when they went back to those countries, they created a lot of problems for governments and civilians there. But Al-Qaeda prior to 2003 was not an Iraqi operation.
All right, to Northern Virginia, Johnny has a comment. Good morning to you.
Yes, hi. I had a comment and a question. The comment is that this is about Greece, that being
sure.
a Greek myself, I believe that the problem is more one of social change than economic. The economic part is kind of the tip of the iceberg for Greece. But the question that I have is concerning the financial bailout. My understanding is that the amounts we're talking about now is for this year's needs. And next year there will be additional needs that may not be as great if the plan works, but may still be pretty hefty. What effect will that have to the dollar-euro relationship and also in the European Union financial situation in general with countries like Spain and Portugal and Iceland, etc.? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Trudy.
Well, obviously, there are many Europeans who worry just about that question, including the citizens of Germany. And I think before you even get to that question, however, you see that the IMF and the EU, if they put together the bailout package, are demanding austerity measures in Greece, which the public is clearly unwilling to undertake, even though the government.
What kind of austerity
measures? Well, for example, cutting back on these enormous pension and vacation packages that ordinary Greeks get, including the large percentage who work for the government. So if the Greek public isn't willing to make sacrifices in order that German citizens should bail them out. And then you wonder whether citizens of other countries would make those sacrifices. Everybody seems to want a free lunch, and that's why this package may fail. And then you have interest rates going up all over Europe and a question mark over the euro.
And we have a message from Steve in the UK. He says it was always known at the outset of the euro that Greece did not qualify for euro membership, but the euro is part of the EU, which is a political project, and Greece was waved through as such. The responsibility for this mess lies solely with the unelected EU Commission, who were quite prepared to waive the rules. Incidentally, the accounts for the EU have not been signed off for over a decade. Roy.
I suppose the EU had this very difficult decision to make when the euro was set up of whether to exclude some of their closest and most you know, earliest members, and Greece was one of them, and whether by bringing them into the EU regime, the euro regime, whether it might be possible for the Commission and others to influence Greece into going in a better direction. What I guess they didn't count on was the dishonesty of the Greek government in faking the figures.
But it's not just the Greek government. Let's talk about the underground economy, which exists in Greece, the barter system, and the fact that a huge percentage of Greek citizens do not pay taxes.
Yeah.
So there you are.
I mean, the thing that your listener talked about in terms of political decisions that were made, I can only imagine how some Europeans are shuddering now to think that if this has happened to Greece, what is going to happen to other countries that who were later admitted after the collapse of the Soviet Union to the European Union, precisely because the United States wanted them to become part of Europe when the Europeans, in fact, didn't, some parts of Eastern Europe. And think about what the Europeans will be thinking about a country like Turkey now. The United States definitely is supporting Turkish membership of the European Union. A lot of Europeans are saying no, and I think what's happening in Greece will be food for thought to a lot of those.
Although I think you will find that the Turkish banks underwent their own reform several years ago, and the Turkish economy is in much better shape
than
the Greek
economy.
All
right, to Julie in South Bend, Indiana. Good morning to you. You're on the air.
Thank you. My question is, one of the guests mentioned that some of the countries who are currently a part of the EU and have the euro are cooking their books. And what I would like her to elaborate on that more, and what kind of safeguards are put in place to prevent these things from happening? Because as we know, we're in such a global economy, anything that each country is doing is going to have an impact.
Trudy.
Well, what Greece did was it underreported its debt in order to
with the help of Goldman Sachs.
Right. So then the question is, who guards the guardians? Who checks the checkers? I mean, that happened in the United States where Moody's, the rating agency, was giving AAA ratings to bonds of companies that should not have had those ratings. You had questions about U.S. accounting firms. So you begin to have doubts about those whose job it is to check the standards of fiduciary reporting. And then that has a ripple effect because nobody trusts anybody.
I hope that answers it, Julie.
It does. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling. And to Montgomery County, Maryland. Hi, Ron. You're on the air.
Oh, Diane. I wanted to say that I see a great resemblance with the Al-Qaeda situation with the Cold War. And eventually the East Bloc imploded, and I think Al-Qaeda will implode. But there is a difference, a major difference, is that with the Cold War, there was a Soviet Bloc or the East Bloc and the West Bloc. But now with this Cold War, I would say from the history of the Islamic world, because the Islamic ideology is so powerful, these entities that try to wield power, they don't need to take that mask off. They keep the Islamic mask on because it's so powerful and it's beneficial to them to use it.
All right, Roy Gutman.
You know, one of the major things that I think we've learned out of the last decade is that a military approach to dealing with al-Qaeda alone is not going to work, that it's a political phenomenon in so many ways, and you have to think politically in order to counter it. You can't, and it's like in al-Qaeda Iraq, you cannot decapitate the movement and then assume it's going to go away. In fact, what you have to do is work on every level with all the governments where al-Qaeda either has taken root or has some kind of connection. You have to deal with every religious organization, certainly the Islamic faith. You've got to deal with NGOs. You've got to deal with real people. And the U.S. in the Bush administration really was out there lecturing, was out there preaching, was out there shooting, but really wasn't thinking.
Roy Gutman of McClatchy News, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. You want to add something, Trudy?
Yes, I want to say that in Iraq, I think that al-Qaeda is much diminished. I think what you see is that a handful of people aided by neighbors who want to interfere in Iraq's affairs can keep it going at a low level, and a handful of people can blow up buildings. But most Iraqis have rejected it. It's a separate issue from whether we should have gone into Iraq. The public has turned against people who bomb mosques.
Let's talk for a moment about Afghanistan. General McChrystal is now saying Marja is under control. What does that mean, Roy?
I'm not really sure, because I don't think that it is. We had a reporter there for several weeks. I guess it was early this month and late last month. And the Americans there are you know, more or less in control during the day of the city. But at night, they aren't. The real problem is that they cannot rely on Afghan police. They cannot rely on the Afghan army. They're now hoping that the Afghan National Police, which is a fairly new organization, is going to come in there at, like a white knight, and actually clean the place up and keep it stable. But the fact is, the Taliban have their ways. They know the people of this town. They are going to come in with money, and they are also supporting poppy growing. The United States is against that. So the Taliban have great advantages. This is not over. It's much too soon to pronounce victory.
But, Trudy, the U.S. is gearing up for a major offensive in Kandahar. You have said and written that what happens in Kandahar is far more dependent on politics than guns.
Yes, and I think the U.S. military understands that full well. In fact, contrary to what's being written, I was in Kandahar a couple of weeks ago. The military does not want to go into the city. They keep saying this is not Fallujah, the city in Iraq that was basically razed in order to make it safe. But in order to control the politics, you have to be able to keep people safe, and you have to be able to convince them that their life is going to be better and give them better local politicians. And what's happening is that the Taliban is killing the good politicians. They just killed the deputy mayor of Kandahar, who was the most honest man in town. And the Americans so far have not been able to influence the corrupt politicians. So this is McChrystal's dilemma. How to solve things politically and economically. And, oh, yes, the Taliban is killing Afghan aid workers as well.
And what's the U.S. relationship with Hamid Karzai at this point, Abderrahi?
Well, first of all, just allow me to say one quick thing about Iraq. Al-Qaeda, this goes back to what Trudy said, Al-Qaeda did not exist in Iraq before 2003. And although most Iraqis disavow Al-Qaeda today, it goes to the very heart of why the U.S. went into Iraq or did not go. It only takes one bombing for them to go to become part of the political dynamics of that country. Hamid Karzai and the Obama administration everyone is saying that things are hunky-dory now. Hamid Karzai is saying that. The Obama administration is saying it. What's happening beneath those statements, I think, is obviously a different situation. Hamid Karzai has an enormous challenge. He cannot be seen to be too close to the U.S. administration. That's why he was making all those noises that the Obama administration did not like. President Obama can say good things about him, but that does not necessarily mean he's satisfied with his performance.
Last word from Abderrahim Fakhara. He's Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Arabic. Trudy Rubin is Foreign Affairs Columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Roy Gutman is Foreign Editor for McClatchy Newspapers. Thank you all so much. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.